Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Amsterdam. It is so nice to see you out tonight. This is a great turnout for Policy in a Pint. I'm Steve Seal. It's always great to be back here. Thanks to the staff of the Amsterdam for having us once again. So, yes, we've been doing this for about 11 years, and it's our collaboration between 89.3 The Current and the Citizens League. Big round of applause for the Citizens League for being a wonderful organization, sponsor these events, co-produce these events, I should say, with us for 11 years running now. That's quite a a bit of longevity. So we're calling tonight's program, Where's the Party? And certainly one of the refrains of this year's presidential election cycle is that all the rules seem to be flying out the window, and very little of the conventional wisdom has prevailed. You know, the pundits have been wrong again and again. I just read another one. I just read another one today saying, you know, I was so wrong. Don't listen to anything that I say, et cetera, et cetera. This is true, obviously, most of all on the Republican side. But on the Democratic side, you know, it's clearly had its share of expectation shattering as well. And at the core of this shattering of precedents has been the fact that the two major political parties have not been able to steer the nominating process, so to speak, in the direction that they traditionally, or at least most often, are able to do, or at least it, you know, it seems like they're most able to do. But it's more than that. The deeper issue, perhaps, at the core of this election's nomination drama has been the question of the political parties themselves. And in the case of the Republican side, you know, questions that have cut to the very essence of what the Republican Party is all about and who its constituents are. I think that this is true certainly on the case of the Democratic side as well, although it's on the other side that the 24-hour news cycle likes to spend a little more time, it seems. So, you know, for generations, we've heard of the smoke-filled rooms, quote-unquote. I was joking ahead of time talking with our guests here. I wonder how many people under the age of 25 have ever even heard the phrase smoke-filled rooms in terms of something where, the big decisions are supposedly hashed out, where the deals are supposedly made in national politics or, you know, politics in general. Are those rooms obsolete? And if so, what is the definition of the political party in 2016 when the traditional role and the power of the political party seems to be dissolving before our eyes? So we'll get to that and more tonight. I really want to, one sort of wonky thing that I want to get to the bottom of tonight is, what exactly do we expect will happen at the Republican convention? What is a brokered convention? What are the predictions of our experts up here tonight? What was it Bill Murray said in Ghostbusters? Dogs and cats living together. Okay. So, what was it? Mass hysteria, dogs and cats living together, right. Okay, here are our guests. Todd Rapp serves as president of Himley Rapp & Company. Prior to joining Himley Rapp, he served as director of Minnesota Government Affairs for Xcel Energy, which at the time was Northern States Power Company, very good. In this role, he developed and managed company strategies for legislative affairs in the areas of energy, environmental, and tax policy. Previously, he served in a number of key positions in Minnesota government and politics. He is a frequent guest commentator and contributor to conversations of national public affairs for Minnesota Public Radio and other news media as well. That's Todd Rapp. Now, our other guest here, Chaz Anderson tonight, partner and co-founder of MZA & Company. I suppose that's MZA, not MZA, like the rapper RZA. It's MZA.
Correct.
Okay, right, okay. And has, for more than two decades of experience in the public and private sectors, as an advisor on state policy, politics, and corporate strategy and communications. She has served in various leadership roles in the Minnesota legislature, including executive director of the Minnesota House of Representatives, and for two governors, including serving as deputy commissioner of education for Governor Tim Pawlenty. She was named top legislative staffer by Politics in Minnesota, and also received an award from the Minnesota Supreme Court for her work on improving access to the judiciary. Easy for you to say. Todd Rapp and Chaz Anderson, please give them a warm welcome for being with us tonight for Policy in a Pint. Thank you both for being here. Format of the show, if you've never been to Policy in a Pint before, here's how it works. I talk to our guests for about a half an hour. Then for the second half of the show, I come to you with my questions. I hold the mic. You don't. No speechifying, please. Well, you know, you can make a point, but I hold the mic. And also, please follow us on Twitter if you're bashful about asking a question but would like to ask it on Twitter. It's #PolicyPint. And my staff of crack producers will make sure that I see the best of your tweets and perhaps pass them along to our guests. So everyone has weighed in on this one, so now it's you guys' turn. Why is what is happening this year, the presidential election, why is it so surprising? Todd's reading my notes, so he knows what questions I'm going to ask before I ask them. So why is it so surprising to the party establishment, do you think? Why, you know, and to the commentators and the pundits as well? Start with you, Todd.
Well, I think the major reason why this is surprising to folks is that they, I think typically analysis in the, especially in the presidential world, tends to build off of what you saw, well, 4 years ago, but actually probably 8 years ago, the last time there was an open race, and then you think back 16 years and so on. But an awful lot has happened to change how people are involved in politics in just 8 years or 16 years. An awful lot has changed on people's perceptions about government. And quite frankly, I don't think anybody really knew how to understand what Donald Trump would be like. I mean, we have never before had a candidate who, within the walls of a political party, has attempted to blow up both parties with the same grenades at the same time. And it's just a very different set of dynamics than we've seen before. And it certainly wasn't going to be the easiest thing to do or the safest thing to do for somebody to predict back in August that Donald Trump was going to be the front runner here on March 14th. Lots of people predicted Hillary Clinton would. Not many felt very safe saying Donald Trump.
Chaz, why do you think that people are so surprised by what has happened?
I think they're surprised, at least on the Republican side. You know, there's always sort of this value of a law and order and rule of how everything works. And in 2012, for the Republican side, it was a bit chaotic. And you had debates, unsanctioned debates every week. You had, you know, one candidate up 1 week, another candidate up another week. And it took, which was the establishment candidate Mitt Romney, a while to secure the nomination. So I think looking back in that lesson, kind of the party leaders thought, we can't have this disorderly process again. We need to have something more orderly. We're going to decide when the debates will happen. We will decide, you know, if delegates are binding in states or not. And we're going to have more control. And the response has been they have less control, actually, of what's going on. And I think it's just inherent of the unrest, the economic unrest Americans feel, and they want some change, and they're not sure what that looks like, but they're hearing people like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump talk about that change in a pretty blunt way, and they're open to that. So I think it's been, as the parties have tried to control what's going on, and I think that even's happened on the Democratic side, they actually have less control the more they actually try to control. And it's a dynamic where candidates can also, they have the internet. It's not as closed process of, you know, how you consume information. It's not, you're going to consume that information on the 5 and 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock news, and whatever the networks feed you is sort of what message you get. Now you can just go on the internet and you can read any blog that you want and decide what you're going to consume for news.
Which is interesting because, I mean, that's not new. Mm-hmm. That phenomenon is not new, but for some reason, this is the year where this has hit. I mean, the internet, social media was certainly around 4 years ago. I can't really recall what sort of nascent state mm-hmm. it was in 8 years ago, but it seems to me that a lot of this seems like it shouldn't have been all that surprising, but everybody on the right side of the aisle seems like they were caught absolutely smack unsurprised, just surprised by how this has gone down. Okay, now if somebody from some other country or planet came to America and said to you guys, explain Donald Trump to me, so you had to do it in, or maybe if you had to explain Donald Trump to an 8-year-old, How would you say, well, this is how this has happened? Do you guys have like an elevator speech to how you explain the Donald Trump phenomenon?
I think, you know what, you go on Twitter and you say, hashtag nothing matters 2016. It just seems like Donald Trump can say and do what he wants, and it doesn't really have a lot of consequences in terms of his supporters. I think Donald Trump's rise, and to the most extent, actually Bernie Sanders' rise, is a lot tied to economics post-Great Recession. Americans are feeling uneasy. You know, a big part of that is the concern about free trade. You know, one of the things I saw a lot from people, I saw some video of folks going to Sanders rallies and Trump rallies, and they say, why are you here? And they said, you know what, I walk into Target, I walk into Walmart, and everything says made in China. Why isn't it made in America? So I think that there's this great unrest, and part of that has to do with some of the policies that have been pushed by Washington, and they view Washington as very broken, not working for Americans, and they're just looking for change, and Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump have showed up and promised that change in a very forceful way.
Okay, I definitely want to circle back to that, because it strikes me that we have talked about that, because there was an article that ran just a couple of days ago by Thomas Frank in The Guardian that put forth that theory that Thomas Frank essentially said, be very careful of those who would say that the Trump phenomenon is about racial tension, is about jingoism, that sort of stuff. Look beneath the surface, because it may be that it's much more about economic concerns than you think. So I do want to get back to that, but Todd, I want to give you a chance first, though. If you had to explain the Trump phenomenon, would you agree with Chaz, or do you have a sort of different elevator explanation?
Well, I mean, first of all, yeah, I agree with Chaz's explanation that a lot of it comes from the economic frustration. It also comes from the economic frustration at both parties. What you're hearing here is people largely inside the Republican Party, but also some disaffected Democrats and independents arguing that neither party is listening very well to them, and neither party is very effective at keeping the promises that they have. I mean, for those of you who are students of political science or history, Trump supporters have a very strong lineage back to Ross Perot supporters, and even in some ways to George Wallace supporters back in 1968. And that lineage is the frustration with the economy, the feel that they're left out, and now there's somebody who can command the media. And that's one of the things Donald Trump does extremely well, and particularly compared to those who he is measured against, the Ted Cruzes, the Marco Rubios, the John Kasiches, and the Jeb Bushes, he is far better with the media than they are.
Sure.
And consequently, I think it's the right era combined with the right type of candidate.
Okay. So, yeah, we will get back to this idea of Trump's message being more economic than other things, because I have a feeling that there are some people out there that don't agree with that, actually. But nevertheless, so, okay, what is Trump's coalition? This is not a referendum on Trump tonight, but one more question on him before we proceed. What is his coalition made up of? Because when we talk about this being a new phenomenon, he's not a strict Republican kind of candidate. He crosses certain kinds of lines, right? I mean, his coalition is made up of what? How would you describe it?
I would say, for the most part, his coalition is made up of Republican voters. And I think there's this misperception that somehow all Republicans, the majority of Republicans support free trade policies. And I think that if you polled both parties, you'd find a lot of strong opposition within the Democrats and Republicans for some of the free trade policies, because of the perception that jobs are going abroad and those are taking American jobs away. But I would say that I think Ross Perot is a good analogy, because as you remember, Ross Perot ran on a very anti-trade message and did quite well as an independent. So I think you're going to see a lot of disaffected voters that perhaps didn't show up, or, you know, they voted for candidates that promised them things that never happened. I think you're going to see he's going to do well in southern states, which is obviously a strength for Republicans. But I think you'll see that he might do well in Rust Belt states as well.
The only reason I laughed is because for a split second, I was reminded of the phrase giant sucking sound, which I don't know if you would have had to have lived through the Perot election to remember what that means.
Yeah.
Does anybody remember what that was the sound of jobs being sucked to Mexico, the giant sucking sound. Anyway, so is it that the coalition and the candidate are different, do you think? Or is it that it's just the candidate is so massively different in this case that he has given voice to frustrations that were there and were latent?
In the end, Donald Trump is a contrarian. When George Bush was president, he registered as a Democrat. When Barack Obama became president, he registered as a Republican. His coalition right now, just to be clear, is 7% of eligible voters in the country. That's what it means to have 35% of the vote in the Republican side as of this point. And he's had a very difficult time getting from 7% to 8 or 9 or 10, even as candidates drop out. And part of the reason why is because, as the Wall Street Journal poll showed, half of the country think he has the wrong ideas and would take the country in the wrong direction. He's going to have a very difficult time moving from where he is right now to being a unifying candidate on the Republican side without some significant changes and, more importantly, expansion from the angry economic message to something which is a little closer to what I would call a Republican philosophy of government, but I don't know if he's connected to that right now.
Same question then for Sanders. Is Bernie somebody who is giving voice to something that is a fundamentally left side of the aisle kind of a set of opinions, but he's just giving voice to them more forcefully and more succinctly and directly? Or is there something that's fundamentally different about what Bernie is saying and proposing?
Well, honestly, I think the most significant difference between Sanders and Trump is that Sanders is in a two-way race against a very well-funded, well-known opponent. If we had a four-way race on the Democratic side, toss in Joe Biden and Cedric Redmond of Louisiana, or maybe Jim Clyburn, throw in those candidates, I don't know that Sanders isn't ahead. But it's a smaller field, more focused. Clinton has a very strong machine behind her. I think Sanders is doing many of the same things Trump is doing, but it's a different playing field, so he doesn't have quite the ability to take 35 or 38% of the vote and make it into the dominant force on the Democratic side.
I have to wipe the gray matter off me from all the heads that just exploded with you saying that's the fundamental difference between Trump and Sanders. But anyway, I'll get to that in a moment. Okay, so how did parties wield power in the past that they're somehow not able to do it today? You know, if we accept the premise that Trump and Sanders, Trump as the front runner, Sanders as the fighting underdog, have gotten further than the party elites ever would have perhaps wanted them to in the past. If we accept that premise, why is that? Does it come down to what you were saying, Chaz, like it's primarily because candidates are vetted in the media and in social media today rather than traditional processes?
Sure. I mean, for the most part, like I said, there's sort of an order in candidates that had the most resources, could get their message out through paid mediums, were able to do well, and then they proceeded. But as the internet has sort of, and social media breaks that down, candidates' voice become very important. Donald Trump, before he ran, had 100% name ID. Americans know who Donald Trump is, so he didn't have to introduce himself to voters. And he very effectively used the media to his advantage in a crowded field in order to get to win the primaries he has won so far. And he's done that actually without, I think just recently he bought some TV ads against Marco Rubio in Florida, but that's the first time he's put up a TV ad during this race, which is pretty incredible to get to this far in the primary in a candidate with a candidate who has not even used paid TV media to get his message out. That's pretty incredible.
Well, he's the guy who said he was, before this even started, that he was going to do that, that he was going to not have to spend all this money in order to succeed in the way that he clearly has. Because, I mean, and he knew how to do that, right? Because he knew exactly how to play the American public or the media or both step by step by step. And he's gotten to where he is, it seems to me. Todd?
Well, on the Democratic side, in the modern era started with the McGovern-Fraser Commission after 1968. For those of you playing the table game, you have to drink when I say McGovern-Fraser Commission. So go right ahead right now, okay? From that,
why is that? Why?
Well, because at that point, the Democratic Party went to rules that required proportional representation. It eliminated something called the unit rule, which is that the party could speak as one voice. No, instead, each delegate got to have their own vote. That's when sub-caucusing became part of the phraseology inside the DFL party. But since that point, whenever we've had an open seat for president, we've actually been more chaotic. I'm going to throw out a couple for you. Michael Dukakis in 1988. On Super Tuesday, he won 7 of 18 primaries, yet he still won the nomination. Bill Clinton had one win in the first 11 caucuses and primaries. Barack Obama didn't clinch until the first week of May. Democrats understand chaos when we're selecting a presidential candidate. I think one of the differences here is that there is a larger-than-life Republican candidate, and I don't think in the era of Ronald Reagan and the Bush family you've seen anyone who can command the cultural stage as well as the political stage in a way that Donald Trump can.
So if we take make the assumption that parties simply want to win, if Trump is so powerful, what is everybody afraid of? Is it because he's actually really not going to? Polls say that he's going to be swamped in a landslide by whoever it is that gets the Democratic nomination?
I think what scares the Republican National Committee and sort of what we call establishment Republicans is who knows what Donald Trump's going to say each day, right? Generally, when you see a Republican candidate, you sort of know where they're coming from, what their issues are. But with Donald Trump, you really don't know. Every day could be a new day. You know, one day he's against eminent domain. The next day he's for it. One day he's, wants to build a wall that's 10 feet higher. Another day he's actually talking about the need for, he's okay with HB1 visas. So you actually never know which Donald Trump shows up. And I think that scares the National Committee.
Because he has no message discipline, and they're not used to that.
He's an entertainer. He wants to entertain his crowd. That's what he's all about. And he has an enormous command over the media because Donald Trump equals ratings, which equals cash. And it's enormous amount of money that the Republican debates, how the networks and the cable TV, they've made off of these debates. Just one example, CNBC, which hosted the debate in October that largely was panned by on the Republican side as being not very orderly, but they sold TV ads for $250,000 for a 30-second ad when before they were selling them for $5,000. So imagine what that means to the media when they can put Donald Trump on the Today Show at 7:15 a.m. at the last minute and advertise it and know that they're going to get people to turn on the Today Show and stay with it. So he has done a masterful job of manipulating the media. He brings them ratings, he brings them cash. It's pretty remarkable, actually. And I feel like Donald Trump sees this campaign as a reality TV show playing out live. There's no script. There's no, this is what I'm going to do each day. It's whatever he feels like when he goes to a stage.
Remember, on the part of party committees, the national committee, there's one presidential race every 4 years. They have U.S. Senate races, they have congressional races, governor's races. Remember, state House and state Senate races have become critical in controlling redistricting around the country. It's been a big part of the Republican strategy and a successful part of it. What scares the national leaders about Donald Trump is he really can't control Trumpdom. And by that I mean is all the people who are supporting him right now, there is very little confidence that they're going to stay and vote for Republicans down ballot. At the same time, if Trump can't attract another, probably 25 or 28% of eligible voters, because typically speaking, a president's elected with about a third of eligible voters voting for them. If he can't attract that, those people stay home. They're not voting on the down ballot races. And that's the scariest part of this. People are sitting in Washington in the RNC headquarters, and they realize that since Donald Trump took over the lead from Ben Carson, Hillary Clinton has won 21 of 24 national polls head-to-head against Donald Trump. That's not a good sign when your candidate is dominating the media coverage.
Sure, I can see that. Okay, so let's talk about possible schisms within parties. So if we have a situation on the Democratic side where Bernie Sanders represents a very doctrinaire a self-avowed Democratic socialist, free education, the kind of platform that he has laid forth, the entire time and very consistently. So very doctrinaire kind of traditional left-wing stuff. And Hillary represents the kind of new Democrat continuation of Bill Clinton, ostensibly. She's certainly moved to the left since Bernie has been in the race. But if that's what she represents, the pro-business, Wall Street kind of stuff, are we seeing a possible schism in the Democratic Party that might take place because of the proof that Bernie has shown that there is an audience for someone who would dare even use the word socialism in America? And similarly, on the Republican side, are we seeing a schism there between very keep your head down kind of pro-business Wall Street Republicans and this very kind of the rise of angry authoritarianism? Or what is really the word? I guess it's authoritarianism. That really was the word that was used in the Vox article that you and I were talking about today, wasn't it, Allie? It was the sort of authoritarian personality in politics. So kind of two things that are arising on the Republican side there. Are the parties potentially going to split into four different things?
Well, parties go through transformations every 30, 40 years, what have you. 68 was for the Democrats, probably 80 was for the Republicans. It might be both parties are going through that transformation right now. We'll see. I think, and by the way, Bernie Sanders, if you call him a Democratic Socialist, he'd probably bristle a little at the first word, but not a bit at the second word.
Which
he'd
is bizarre. I mean, imagine that. Yeah.
But I can't remember a time, and I just may not have a good enough memory, but I can't remember a time where age was such a critical factor on the Democratic side as it is to explain the difference between Sanders and Clinton. I mean, age and race are greatly defining which candidate does well in which state. And I think anytime age becomes that kind of factor, you are seeing a fundamental transformation. I don't think younger voters believe that the Clintons answer the questions anymore. And let's face it, if Hillary Clinton wins and she serves for 8 years, the Democratic Party will have largely been dominated by the Clinton family for 32 years. Maybe it's not that surprising that we're seeing a challenge that's largely built around voters under the age of 45 who just aren't sure that that new Democratic idea is the right idea anymore.
Chaz, is the Republican Party going to split into two from a pro-business, keep-your-head-down party and a nativist, protectionist, totally foreign ideas for the Republican Party?
Well, what I found very interesting is that right before the Iowa caucuses, the Des Moines Register conducted a poll, and they tested messages which worked against Trump, Cruz, and then Hillary and Bernie Sanders. And what I found interesting is that the best message actually in the race was against Cruz on the Republican side, which is Ted Cruz won his U.S. Senate seat because his wife works for Goldman Sachs and they're tied to Wall Street. That was actually a very effective attack on Ted Cruz. It wasn't that he was born in Canada. And so that was a very effective. If you look in the left, the most effective argument was the one Sanders was making against Hillary, which is she's too tied to Wall Street. She takes money from Wall Street. She's too connected. America needs something different. So here you have both bases of the party essentially saying they're anti-Wall Street messages. So I think there has to be, by the parties, by both parties, some response to and some change in order to keep the bases to keep your base together. But I found it extremely interesting that message tested well in both bases of the party.
Here is the million-dollar question then. If those concepts are resonating with voters, why is it that they're resonating more with Trump people? In other words, why is Trump why does he have more of a gravitational pull than Sanders?
I think part of it is the difference between the two races right now. I mean, again, the number of candidates and the types of candidates in there. Part of it is because there is this belief, and again, it's a fairly small group of eligible voters, but there's belief that Trump owes nobody anything. And you can list all you want, all the ways that his corporations have lobbied state legislatures or Congress, all the special deals that he got, all the ways he's interacted with government, but there's this fundamental belief he doesn't owe them, therefore he'll tell it like it is. But here's the problem. When you poll the entire electorate, only about 18% agree with the statement, Donald Trump tells it like it is. So in the primary world it's working, it's still questionable whether it's going to go beyond these primaries.
You guys are just not going to bite, are you, on the idea that it's the racism part and Donald Trump's appeal? You're not going to bite on that. Okay, so why is it that Trump then, if he has so much criticism for, if he has certain criticisms for the Republican Party, why did he run as a Republican and not as an independent?
You know, it goes back to third-party candidacies. Even though Ross Perot did quite well, it's very hard to get access to the ballot. It's a much tougher road to carry. And I think in Trump's mind, he feels like he's renting the Republican Party. If he is the nominee, the Republican Party will report to Trump. They will not, the Republican Party will not, you know, it will not be a coordination. The Republican Party will do as I say. And you know, if he is the nominee and they and he doesn't like what they're doing, you're going to hear about it. He is going to publicly talk about that. So I think from his standpoint, it was the avenue that he wanted to hook his platform to. He saw a lot, I think, you know, a lot of unrest, a lot of economic unrest, a lot of unease with immigration, and he used that to his advantage and used his persona, his reality TV persona, to make that happen. So, but make no mistake, he didn't say, I am completely 100% Republican, I completely believe in the principles. He's renting the Republican Party.
Interesting. Now, we're going to, cool. We're going to get going. Now, okay, before I start taking your questions, and please think of them because I bet we'll have a few to squeeze in here in the time we have allotted. You guys are going to have to break down for me what's going to happen at the Republican convention. So what in the world is going to happen? What is a brokered convention, first of all? Can you sum up what that means? And is there a difference between a brokered convention and a contested convention?
You know, a contested convention is one that goes several ballots and a consensus candidate wins. You know, if let's just say that all four of the candidates alive right now go to the convention, they duke it out, one emerges. What's interesting is that you need 1,237 delegates to get there. Trump is at about 460, so he may not be at a majority when he gets to the convention. So on the first ballot, it's everyone knows how it's going to go, and then after that, it could completely change. What could happen, actually, you could literally have a candidate who didn't run for office, didn't put his name out there, didn't spend one dime, show up at a convention and become the candidate. That's very rare. And frankly, Republicans have trouble with this convention strategy. I know that's Kasich's strategy, is I'm going to win Ohio and then I'm going to take it to the convention. And this happened in the 40s with Wilkie. And Wilkie went six ballots, and he wasn't the leader, but finally emerged as the candidate, and that's sort of Kasich's strategy. But the problem with that is that you have Trump voters that, in their minds, it would be if you went to a convention, which in their minds is an infomercial. We know conventions, at least on the Republican side, it's just an infomercial for 3 days.
We've all grown up with them being infomercials, yeah.
And so if someone goes in there and Trump has the lead and he loses the nomination to another candidate, then it's going to appear that the party actually took the nomination away from Trump.
You betcha.
So it's a very difficult strategy to pull off. It's a great theory for the DC insiders and the establishment to talk about. It's really difficult to pull off.
Just so everybody understands that if you haven't been through this party process before, the Republican Party, these parties aren't named in the Constitution and their rules aren't set by federal law. The Republicans will gather, I think 112 of them who serve on the Rules Committee, and they will review the rules of the last convention and the current temporary rules of the party, and they will propose rules of the full convention, and those delegates will decide how they will handle those situations based on those rules. And if they're 2 or 3 days into this and they don't like it, then someone needs to make a motion to suspend the rules and they'll start to debate it. But they will determine this themselves, how they work their way through this. Now, currently, they have a rule that says that in order even to be nominated from the floor, you have to have the majority of delegates in 8 states, of which I believe right now we only have one candidate, if that, in the Republican side who can meet that rule. I'm guessing that's a rule that won't exist by the time that convention begins, and they're likely to give each other as much flexibility to deal with the problems that may come up if it's going to be a brokered convention.
Wow. Do you think that those who would put forth the idea of changing the nominee should they have the opportunity to do that, would worry about, you know, all these images they've seen of angry mobs and think, you know, I don't know that I really want to tempt those people.
I mean, if you're asking me to predict what 2,500 delegates to the Republican National Convention might consider the most important issue as they're picking a candidate who never even put his or her name in the ring for primaries or caucuses, I'm sorry, somebody a lot smarter than I am is going to have to figure out what's at the top of that list. I think if they reject Donald Trump, though, I think that is going to be a reason why, because they feel like they've lost control. And remember, again, it's not necessarily the presidential race that those delegates are worried about. It may be the U.S. Senate, congressional, governor's races, all those other races. If the presidential candidate is a remarkably positive tool for local candidates most years, and they're not sure right now if Donald Trump will be helpful for them.
Jazz.
Yeah, I mean, if that happens, I think the only reason why it happens is because the party and the establishment fears Donald Trump on top of the ticket and what it does down ballot, what it does for U.S. Senate races, what it does congressional races, legislative races in states. And so that's really a strategy where if the votes are there, I mean, that's a very difficult proposition to say, we're just going to kick off the person with the most votes and elect someone who hasn't even been in the game. But that would be the only situation of reason why that would happen. It was because there would be key people who believe that Donald Trump really would cause damage down ballot for Republicans.
All right, well, it's time to take some questions. I'll start right here.
Yeah, two questions. One is, can you talk about the Democrats with the superdelegates and how that's going to have a bearing? And also the comment was made about the public isn't happy with the parties and the parties haven't delivered, but we've had the divided Congress and presidency, which has led to some of this not delivering.
Yeah.
I think first on the second question, I think that is true as to why things haven't become law, but I think the frustration, particularly among Trump supporters, is that they think they hear one thing out of candidates of a party, but then they go to Washington and they do something else, from the beginning. And I think that's where some of the disconnect is. On the issue of superdelegates, this is something that only the Democratic Party has, where members of Congress, U.S. senators, other party officials are unpledged delegates that are selected not through a nomination or a caucusing process, but because of their position of leadership. It's a fairly large percentage of the delegates, and right now where, you know, the Clinton and Sanders in open contest, maybe it's 60-40 or 58-42 is the lead that Clinton has. Among superdelegates, it's 9-1 or 10-1 or 11-1. And that's why you see Clinton, even though that she's only won 14 of 23 contests, you see her delegate total being so high. Problem is that they're unpledged. So even if they publicly say they support Clinton, they can go to the convention and on the first ballot do whatever they want. And Sanders, correctly, is putting down the challenge. He's saying, if I win more pledged delegates, the super delegates need to support me. It's a very good argument. It's exactly what the discussion was when Obama and Clinton faced each other in 2008. And I think it will become very difficult for super delegates to not support Bernie Sanders if the Clinton campaign collapses enough that Sanders takes over the pledged delegate lead.
I'm just going to add to that, superdelegates, I'm going to leave Todd to talk about that, but I'll just add to that is that I don't think it's divided government that people are frustrated with, because I don't think anyone sits around and says, well, of course they shouldn't get along, they're in different parties, and I think people expect, whatever party you're from, that you should do your job, go to Washington, go to St. Paul, and get things done. And so I think the frustration is even not with divided government, but there's people who felt when the Democrats controlled the White House and Congress, when Republicans controlled the White House and Congress in the last decade, that they didn't really get the job done either. So I think this is a long stem frustration of, it doesn't matter who we send out there, the job just doesn't get done, and we're frustrated, and we're taking it out right now.
Here's a question for Chaz that came in online. Do you think that Republicans are more frustrated or more frightened by what Donald Trump does say or what they're simply afraid he might say?
I think both, all of the above. he's a very unpredictable candidate. And, you know, that's why supporters like him for the most part. I earlier said that, you know, he can make comments and statements, nothing matters, 2016. He still has his supporters despite what he says. But I think the fear of what he has said and how that can be used and what he might say in the future are both fears.
Mm-hmm. Next question.
So let's say Bernie rides the big wave into the White House and Democrats true to form don't vote in down-ticket elections and for sure don't turn out for midterms. How does he not become Barack Obama with a slate of great ideas that he can't get a goddamn thing passed?
He doesn't. Thank you very much. Next question. No. Really, valid question.
Well, first of all, I agree overall with the challenge for Sanders in that he doesn't have a strong following even among the elected Democrats right now in Washington, and a Sanders victory would probably not result in a flip of the House anyway from Republican to Democrat, so he'd be facing a lot of the same challenges as Barack Obama. Having said that, I think the evidence is pretty clear that Sanders does not have the Trump problem of the party won't be there for him. A significant percentage of the Clinton supporters say they can also support Sanders. Is that enough for him to beat Trump? Well, if you were predicting today, you'd say probably, but let's face it, what's going to decide that election's in the future? It's not in the rearview mirror. Is it enough for Sanders to, if he was going head-to-head against Kasich or if a brokered convention chose Paul Ryan? I'm not quite as confident to say that Sanders could beat them. He may not get enough from independents in order to win that election. But there's no question that as long as there's divided government, having a president that's farther to the left than Barack Obama is absolutely a challenge for governing. There is no question about that.
Next question.
Don't you think the media, I think, plays like a role in some of this, and in the fact that the parties have kind of lost control of their media messaging, like with the internet being the primary source where people get their information from? And I guess if that is the case, then don't you think that maybe the rise of Trump and Sanders kind of represent a certain disaffected part of the population where, for example, on the right, people, there's this social conservative contingency where the Republican Party has like lost those battles and has failed to like reform itself along new ideological like perspective. And then on the right, I think a lot of people might be disenfranchised with the liberalism of how Obama campaigned, but then as, you know, he's had to make compromises and whatnot, and then you throw the lobbying and all that in there, and the parties have an agenda that necessarily isn't serving the people per se, but you have this branding issue where the right equals free markets, the left equals good government, but yet really it's not happening. So, sorry, I know that's kind of all over the place, but I guess what I'm trying to say is how does the loss of control of the messaging as a result of more transparency, how do the parties like get control of that, I guess?
Would you say that what you're asking is the inability to deliver on what happens in primaries, what you promise in primaries to your actual constituents, just create more frustration exponentially on down the road? Kind of like that?
Sure, and frankly, I'm not sure there's much really the party can do to control the messaging, given that, especially at the power of a candidacy of like Donald Trump, where he can just go directly over the party, into the media, get his message out there. And so the power of the candidacy is important, and both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have demonstrated that. The more the party tries to control, the less control they have. They wanted an orderly process in 2016, and they have chaos right now. So, and then the other part, too, is I really think this is about disaffected voters and on the economic message, not so much social conservative, because Donald Trump is not a social conservative. Donald Trump, you know, is running on economic issues. He's been accused of bringing race into the issue, and he's been running on immigration. That was what he ran on when he first announced his candidacy. And it really hasn't been about social conservatism. He would not be a social conservative, and yet he is taking a large share of evangelical voters. So there's really something happening out there, I think, on both sides. and something we need to wrestle with. And I don't know if it means a transformation of the party, but it's definitely something that has been brewing and is now out in the open.
And the media have opened the doors wide open. We're seeing what's happening behind the curtain in the delegate selection process in a way that we haven't before. And I think sometimes what ends up happening is that we compare how the general election sounded 8 years ago or 16 years ago, whatever, to how the nomination process sounds right now. We have never had this kind of intense coverage of the nomination process. It is too early for parties to step in and even try to execute control. Party leaders in Washington are relatively agnostic right now. They have very strong opinions, and they do want to step in and make sure that their candidates are well supported. But by and large, they have to take one step back and allow the delegates and the funders to control the process right now. We've just never seen media coverage like this. And consequently, well, I'll put it this way. Donald Trump is the first guy to participate in the presidential debate, to figure out that the first thing he should do when the debate's over is not kiss his wife, but to walk right down to a reporter from the network that just covered the debate and analyze the debate for the network. Donald Trump does that wonderfully, and it's just a different way of covering elections than we're used to, and we shouldn't be surprised that a reality show star has figured out how to do this better than other candidates.
Which convention comes first? You guys know that?
Yes.
Democratic convention comes first?
The Republican convention starts first. It may not end first, according to what Chaz just
said. Oh, are you kidding? Okay. See, now that's interesting. Because I was going to say, if the Democratic convention came first, then that would potentially inform all kinds of chicanery that might happen at the Republican convention. Anyway, interesting. Okay.
Now, I'm not going to bash the media, but I keep looking that if the voters are angry because of the lack of ability to get things done in Congress, isn't that to a great extent because the parties have pushed such a divisive message that they won't allow a middle of the road and a moderate candidate to come forward and bring a collaborative message? I think the parties are pushing people apart, and you're getting what you deserve.
I'll just add to that. You know, part of it is not just the parties, but there's a long list of outside groups that come in and try to influence the process, and they have every right to do that. In 2013, we had a federal government shutdown. One of the messages was, well, we can get President Obama to repeal Obamacare if the leaders just worked hard enough and actually negotiated and convinced him to repeal his landmark legislation. And people believed that, so they called and they said, shut government down until you have Obamacare repealed. And so it's not necessarily the party that's pushing these issues or pushing a certain position. In fact, leaders don't like parties to tell them what to do. They like to kind of direct that. But it's now we have a long list of outside groups that have that ability to push the left, to push the right into positions. I'd love to hear Todd's take on that too, but that's what I see is the rise of more outside groups, more voices, which, you know, it's something we pride ourselves in. You should have every right to say what you want to say, and you have that right in this country, but I think that's also moved the discord in Washington.
I agree with what Chaz is saying. Let me add two other things. Number one is, as frustrated as I am with Joe Scarborough's man love of Donald Trump, I think the media has basically done their job. More people are turning out in primaries. More people are watching the debates. It's not the media's fault, frankly, that the candidates are who they are. I think there has been more analysis of Trump's position than just about any challenger I've seen in many, many years. It's just that it's overwhelmed by all of the Trump on Trump that's going on out there. But we're seeing every rally he does, you're seeing what happens live. I mean, I think there's a really positive thing there in a very chaotic result. The second thing I would say is that if you want to blame anything for the fact that Washington looks and sounds too polarized, look at the way the lines are drawn. 90% of congressional districts are safe. 10% are challenged. I mean, If you want to know a reason why the Beltway has lost touch with their districts, it's because they only have to respond to about 40% of the people in their district because they're relatively safe incumbents.
So who are they answering to? Their donors. Is that what it is?
I'd go some steps beyond that. I think they're answering to their base, what the base looks like, and at about 10% of the districts, they're answering more to the middle.
Okay. Next question.
So where does that put Senator Grassley as the head of the Judiciary Committee and his obstructionist position on the Supreme Court nomination?
He's
been there forever.
Senator Grassley, from the senator from Iowa, our neighboring state. You know, it's interesting, once Justice Scalia passed away, I saw a national poll conducted, and national polls mean whatever they mean. They mean very little in presidential races. But it said, well, half of the country is divided. Half said wait to the new president, and half said nominate now. And so the country's even divided about the issue. It's really the president should put forth a nominee, and the Senate will act if they act. But I'm not sure it will have an impact on the presidential race. It just really a lot of the issues of who the candidate's going to be needs to be worked out, and what issues emerge. Every time you think, well, this is going to be a foreign policy race, or this is going to be about domestic policy, it is actually the opposite, I've found. So I guess when pundits try to predict what's going to be impactful, we've been pretty bad at about this cycle, so I think I might take a pass.
I'm going to give you a cynical answer, and I apologize in advance for that. I will tell you, first of all, that I do believe, it is a personal opinion, that the Senate should, in all good conscience, take up the nominee. That doesn't require them to approve the nominee, but they should take up the president's nominee. I will also say, in all good conscience, that if the situation was reversed, I truly believe the Democrats would be doing the exact same thing you are seeing right now. I'd add one other thought about the Supreme Court as an issue. It really means a lot to, I think, some core voters. There's no question in my mind it does, on both sides. But for most people, the Supreme Court is a medium through which issues flow. And if people can't connect this Supreme Court battle with real issues that affect people's lives on a daily basis, if they can't connect the dots, it's probably not going to be as significant an issue in this campaign as maybe we felt like it was going to be when the Scalia death was announced.
We are coming up on 7. I'm going to take maybe 3 or 4 more, and that'll be our evening. So, next question.
You guys, how much do you think talk radio is fueling Trump's campaign? You know, you listen to Limbaugh, Hannity. I do. I know maybe a lot of people don't hear, but they are so down on the congressional Republicans. They almost seem to want multiple government shutdowns per year. They let every gaffe and misstatement by Trump go by, almost, you know, giving it cover. How much do you think they've driven this whole campaign?
I think talk radio has gradually moved from being a powerful influencer to being more of a mouthpiece of what people believe, so it can aggregate opinion, maybe. I think it's been replaced to a large extent by cable right now. I mean, the single most trusted news source among Republicans is Fox News. The single least trusted source among Democrats is Fox News. And the most trusted sources are MSNBC, the New York Times, and NPR. I mean, that's kind of where things have gone. Having said that, there are moments that both Limbaugh and Hannity are such good entertainers that they're able to take an issue and help spread it. Maybe they put more fuel on the fire than would normally be put there. But I think it's talk radio was, 8 years ago, 12 years ago, there's no question. They were breaking the rules of politics, but I think now we've seen cable and the internet take over those roles. That's my opinion.
Sure, and talk radio, cable, it's all about viewership. Not a lot of viewership in Kumbaya, so they're obviously going to be repeating a message to their base, and it's going to be sharp and pointed. And even though Fox News is the news of Republicans, they also have been in war with Donald Trump, which is sort of in kind of indicative of the fight within the party when Roger Ailes versus Donald Trump send press releases out against each other. Roger Ailes is the head of Fox News. And so I think that it's just reinforcing messages that were already out there, and it's shifted not only on talk radio, but they're now those same messages for the Democrats. It's MSNBC, Republicans, it's Fox News. It's just, especially in the evening, it's just repeating those partisan messages.
Next question.
Do you think that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are going to be able to effectively handle whatever the rest of the world throws at them should they become the nominees, or namely China? Do you think that they're going to be able to effectively deal with everything else that's going on, not just domestic policy?
I think there's a lot of questions about Donald Trump and his ability to manage affairs on the world stage. Obviously, he's already picked fights with countries like China. That's probably his number one target. Mexico is another one, our neighbors to the south. He's actually warmed up to Putin, which is unusual. It's Putin has been the enemy of the Republican Party since Russia and Soviet Union since Ronald Reagan. Who knows what's going to happen? I think at this point, you know, voters are going to decide. I think it's going to be more about a domestic race than a foreign policy race, unless there's some world event that changes that course, and that could happen. But, I mean, I think there's serious questions about if Donald Trump has a temperament to be in the world stage and just in the recognition that America is a world leader and other countries look to America as to what's happening, their foreign policy, and he's a big question mark in that respect. He would say he's totally awesome, though. So
yeah. It's going to be awesome, right?
Yes.
And if the worry about Trump is maybe how he handles those situations that are more tense, more difficult, maybe with folks who aren't directly our allies, I think the Sanders challenge is whether or not he'll bring our international allies together behind him, and frankly, whether he will bring the leadership of Congress, the Democratic leadership, behind him on the direction he wants to go. But we've had untested people before. I mean, we have. And I think that's, I've still got some optimism that when two relatively intelligent gentlemen, I think both Trump and Sanders are very smart people, I think they, when they get into office, that that they'll understand that the especially in international affairs, the role requires a level of moderation that maybe during the campaign you didn't see.
I have a question about, let's say the cards actually fall in such a way that Bernie gets the nomination. Is there a possibility of there being some sort of intra-party sabotage because Bernie is so outside of the party structure? I mean, you know, you talked about Trump essentially renting the Republican Party earlier. You also made a statement about how, you know, kind of humorously, but, you know, for a long time, I mean, Bernie was elected calling himself a socialist in his home state, and in some ways he's kind of renting the Democratic Party as well. So do you think that there's any chance of there being a breakdown between Bernie and the Democratic Party?
Well, I would... Go ahead.
I was going to say, if Bernie Sanders is the nominee, at this point, you know, we'll see how that plays out this week and in coming weeks. But I think definitely some of the same, you might see some of the same rift that's going on with Donald Trump, maybe less visible than what's happening with Donald Trump. But, I read an article that he actually didn't want to run on the Democratic ticket. As you said earlier, it's a little uneasy with the Democratic Party. And I think there'll be some who are a little uneasy with having a self-proclaimed socialist running on the party ticket. But
no.
You know what? I go back to hashtag Nothing Matters 2016. It is what it is.
What is that, by the way? Being a Twittiot, I don't really know what that is. I seriously, I'm not like the worst Twitterer in the world. So what is hashtag Nothing Matters 2016?
It's something I picked up when I was on Twitter because people kept saying, you know, Bernie Sanders would say he's a socialist, and people would say, the race is over. And then you'd see Donald Trump saying, let's build a wall. And everyone would say, the race is over. Or
okay,
he would insult John McCain.
None of the rules apply.
None of the rules apply.
Okay, gotcha.
And so everyone said that was it for those candidates.
Right.
And actually, it wasn't it. So every time something happens, it's sort of the rules are thrown out.
Yeah, yeah, Todd.
Well, to be fair, Bernie Sanders hasn't yet called Hillary Clinton a liar or Little Hillary. I mean, it's not been that kind of race yet. And he actually had a chance, I think, and he made what I would argue is a strategic mistake, but I think he was being true to himself when he did not take on Hillary Clinton on the emails during the debate. So, I mean, Sanders is, I think, honestly trying to change the Democratic Party from the inside as opposed to taking a sledgehammer to it and trying to break the car apart. Having said that, it definitely is going to change campaign strategy if that 1 in 100 or 1 in 50 chance comes and Bernie Sanders is the candidate. And it really is those kind of odds right now. I mean, we're not looking at a situation where Sanders is, for example, in as good a shape as Cruz. I would even argue Sanders is not in as good a shape as Kasich is right now to win the nomination. It's wow. Just the numbers are just too daunting at this point, and he hasn't demonstrated that he can clear out a state 70-30 or 65-35 the way Clinton can.
Half the people in this room are now just like staring into their beers thinking of what have you just told me? Okay, next question.
I just wanted to go back to kind of the idea of the brokered convention. So like the last time we saw that was in 1948 with Dewey and then 52 with Stevenson, and in both.
How old are you, man?
Mid-50s.
This kid is awesome. All right, go on.
But in both those races, both those candidates lost, and there was a lot of division within the parties. And you know, in 48, that was the Republicans, and 52, that was the Democrats. So I'm wondering what your prediction is for the upcoming Republican race, if we do have a brokered convention, if that division is going to play out the same way it did in the late 40s, early 50s.
This week we have, you know, two important states up, Ohio and Florida. They're both winner-take-all states. It looks like Trump will win Florida, which is 99 delegates. It's a lot. Actually, Florida changed the rules from proportional to winner-take-all to benefit Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio, and it's actually going to benefit Donald Trump tomorrow. But it was a good move. So, but I really think, though, if it's going to be very hard to unseat Donald Trump if he comes in with a strong majority of delegates, and it's just going to be extremely difficult to make that case and to unseat him. And, you know, right now, I think all these scenarios playing out about a contested and a brokered convention are sort of wishful thinking. If Kasich can't win Ohio tomorrow, it's very wishful thinking. So tomorrow is an important day for the Republican nomination.
And don't be so sure that a brokered convention looks something like chaos. I understand that. But there's a lot of time after the conventions. These are July conventions. There's a lot of time to repair problems, develop a message, and move forward. And let's not forget, I mean, Hillary Clinton has some of the largest negatives of any presumptive presidential nominee that in my lifetime. And it's not whoever her opponent is, it's going to be a tough, up and down, difficult battle for her to get to 270, 280, 290 electoral votes. And so there's no question a brokered convention can be played wrong. It can be dangerous, but I'm not sure I would bet right now this presidential election that a brokered convention would be universally bad for the Republican Party.
All right, I'm going to take two more. Sorry. Okay, I'm going to take two more.
Hi, I'm asking about the billionaire George Soros. He's the biggest backer of Hillary. But today I learned he's also backing John Kasich. And I just wanted your opinion on that strategy. I know that billionaires like to back both parties, so they're always invited to the victory party. But this one's got me confused. So what's your opinion about George Soros backing John Kasich?
I don't know. When I go to Canterbury, I often bet on two horses in the same race. I don't think my guess is that there's two ways to answer it. The non-cynical side says, hey, he likes Kasich. My cynical side, and I think I might be right, is that he likes the idea of a brokered convention, and one of the best ways to do that is to help Kasich win a few big states.
This is the first time hearing George Soros support John Kasich. I will say George Soros is a very unliked person in the Republican Party. I would say that would hurt John Kasich in the Republican Party if George Soros was helping him. If that's true. So either that's, you know, John Kasich should denounce the support from George Soros, or it's a false rumor.
Don't you?
He's the great Satan, as far as you know, Republicans are concerned.
Don't you all wish you had enough money that you could actually bet on both sides like that? I mean, wouldn't that be amazing?
All right. Okay. Here's where I ask: what is the question? Who has the most burning question in the room? Any burning desires? Okay. She has it.
Well, I just want to follow up on a couple of things that have happened to talk about how you would predict things breaking down and moving forward not being the same as we know it, particularly as it comes from this onslaught of young people. And I have a nonprofit. I work with the millennials. They've jumped over us, okay? They've stayed out of the politics. At least the ones I know, they have stayed out of the politics. They say, we get things done. That's what we're doing. I also have a 21-year-old son studying abroad. They're all over Europe. And they are a global group. So with the fact that we have people moving beyond any of these structures and getting things done and globally embracing and starting up sharing communities and business models, how is that going to work, as you see it, for the demise of the two-party system and the legislature as we know it for the downstream voters or the downstream legislative voting?
Neither of them can conceive of what she's talking about, you must understand.
Let me start by saying is that I don't think what we're seeing here is the demise of the two-party system. I think we are seeing some fundamental questions be asked, and I think the interesting part is that both parties are dealing with this in the same year. In the end, we are not a very good parliamentary system. We are a far better two-party democracy, and I can't see the impact of this year or even in the near future us going to three parties or four parties or five parties. What I can see is two parties really struggling to figure out where their core is. But I think most of what we see happens in politics will still happen through these two parties. If we were going to have a change, by goodness, Jesse Ventura would have been part of the reason why the change happened. And as soon as the personality got out, so did the influence of that party.
Yeah, but nothing matters 2016.
A little matters 2016.
All right, Chaz?
I'll just say, I think with millennials, they're not issue by issue. They're not easily placed in one and the other. I think it's going to depend on issues, where they go, what they support. There's some issues they're more supported from the left. There's some issues more supported on the right. And so I think they're disinclined to get put into one or the other. And so you're going to see a lot of, you know, where candidates have to reach out to an age group directly. They're not going to go and get involved in the party in a cause. They're going to support a candidate for what that candidate believes in. And I think, you know, that'll make politics a little more interesting. And I think that's probably, it's not a bad direction. I think it could be very beneficial to the country, but millennials are the largest generation since the baby boom, so they're going to be a powerful force in this country, and we'll see how that plays out. I think that they're, you know, literally candidates are going to have to more and more retail directly reach voters, whether it's through social media, direct retail campaigning, and millennials will make up their mind from what they see, and they want to see authentic leaders.
I'll make a prediction. We're not that far away from candidates having their own channels on TV, if there is TV then, by the way, because that might be obsolete very quickly. But I could see very easily 4 or 8 years from now that being a very significant way that people get their political coverage.
That's an interesting idea. Wow. Okay, so here's the deal. If you follow us on Twitter, you will find out. Actually, follow The Current, and then you'll find out when the audio for this program is going to be posted. If you want to revisit it, listen to it again. Also, the conversation will continue on Twitter, hashtag PolicyPint. And I just want to thank our wonderful guests for an excellent conversation tonight. Chaz Anderson, Todd Rapp, thank you both for being here. You guys are awesome. Great questions. thanks, as always, to the Citizens League, Sean Kershaw, Pahua Hoffman, Jan Unstead. Citizens League, so pleased to be partners with them for 11 years running. And a little tip of the hat to Martin Sabo tonight, who passed away. We were talking a little bit about Martin Sabo, and the reason is because even though he was on the Democratic side of the aisle, his desire for public engagement and the conversation across the aisles is something that made him somebody who I think set trends and made examples for a lot of Minnesotans and a lot of Americans. And he was intimately involved with the Citizens League. He was a big supporter of the Citizens League. And rest in peace, Martin. And thank you very much to my producer, Jane Solinger from NPR News. Thanks to Amanda Lilly for helping out tonight, Ali Lozoff as well, and the Amsterdam once again for hosting us. Stay tuned for more information on The Current as far as when our next Policy in a Pint will be. And we thank you very much for coming out. The Amsterdam remains open. Thank you so much. I'm Steve Seal. We'll see you on the radio.